Mondscheinsenklade, als diese romantische Melodie. In denen, die heute zum ersten Mal zuhören, möchte ich kurz wiederholen, dass dies die Sendezeichenmusik des Major Glenn Miller ist. Es ist seine eigene Komposition. Deutsche Soldaten, vor das Mikrofon tritt jetzt persönlich Major Glenn Miller.
How do you do, Ilsa? Here we are again for our short rendezvous, and I wish to thank you for the nice things you said about the members of our orchestra. I'd like to add that you find all nationalities among them. There are even quite a number of boys whose parents came from Germany, Russia, Italy, and many other countries.
Ach, das war so schön.
Don't get sentimental, Ilsa. That's bad for your heart. I mean, das ist nicht gut für das Herz.
Sie haben recht, Herr Major. Gönnen wir meinem Herzen und ihren tüchtigen Musikern eine kleine Pause und übergeben wir das Mikrofon unserem Berichterstatter.
Also, we now call on Sergeant Ray McKinley, who has more rhythm than a cat on a hot brick.
Today, even when I mention this to Americans, they find it hard to believe in. Some of the tapes that you may have heard and that I have where Glenn Miller's orchestra and Glenn Miller himself is speaking German and singing in German are classics. It's the only place they exist because, unfortunately, Glenn Miller was a victim of the war himself and died in an airplane crash about a year after the programs began on Soldat and Cinder Kelly.
The success of the high-power medium wave transmitter caused heated debates within the British government. The BBC was furious that it hadn't been given the chance to get airtime on Aspidistra. But when too many British bombers were being shot down by German fighter aircraft, the Air Ministry went to see Winston.
Churchill discussed this with the Chief of Staff and said, well, I don't want to lose this program, but for short times, yes, they can have it. So we started an operation, which we then called Dartboard at the time. The Germans were having trouble controlling their fighters by shortwave and ultra-shortwave because the RAF were carrying their own jammers with them. The Germans decided that since they couldn't do that to control the fighters, they controlled them on medium waves. Yeah. And they turned some of the medium wave transmitters into control transmitters against the bombers. This is where we came in. People in the Air Ministry decided the best thing to do would be to jam that. So we were asked to do what we could on that. Well, what happened was that the Air Force monitored very carefully and gave us information on a special telephone line which we had put in, where they were going and what frequencies they thought the Germans would be using to control. And we would put up a program which consisted of yesterday's monitoring of what the Germans were doing. The program was monitored at Kingstown in Kent and passed to us on a line, and we put it onto the transmitter, and of course it was giving instructions to the fighters to go where they went yesterday.
Well, imagine getting this kind of sound in the headphones.
And this worked very well indeed, apparently. Bomber Command told the signals people that this was very effective and credited us with saving 20 and 30 bombers a night.
But weren't you the target of the bombing? Because obviously the Germans must have realized that this was a medium wave operation and coming from Sussex.
Interesting point, but no, we were never attacked directly by bombs except by one airplane that dropped a lot of incendiary bombs, which we think were simply unloaded because they all fell about a mile away from the station. I mean, dozens of them. No, we were never attacked except when it came much later to the Doodlebugs, to the V1 flying bombs. And they didn't attack us, but they flew so close to the ground because Cobra was the highest point between the sending point and London that they skimmed over the hill very close. And on one ghastly occasion, when a Doodlebug flew right under the guise of the mast and hit nothing, went straight through without touching anything. Everybody ducked, put their fingers in their ears. But it was just a near miss.
Operation by Aspen Estra was how it helped to cause confusion in Germany during an Allied air raid. Unlike Britain, which had synchronized several broadcast transmitters onto one frequency, the German broadcasting network consisted of several regional transmitting stations. Tuning up the dial in Northwest Europe, you could find the broadcasts from Berlin on several channels, one from a transmitter in Cologne, and then a little further up the band was the transmitter in Hamburg, carrying the same program. Because a radio transmitter can be used as a navigational aid, it wasn't surprising that when Allied bombers got within 50 miles of a German broadcast transmitter, it was taken off the air. The British decided to take advantage of the dead air to put out confusing messages. Let's take an example. The British Air Ministry would advise the secret broadcasting complex in Milton Bryant, north of London, that the target that night was Hamburg. Two radios at Milton Bryant were then set up to monitor two different regional German transmitters, one broadcasting from Cologne, let's say, and the other coming from Hamburg. A beat frequency oscillator on the radio tuned to Hamburg's channel was then switched in, giving a steady tone. Two telephone lines from the radios at Milton Bryant fed the output to the Aspidistra transmitter site at Crowborough. The giant medium wave transmitter was tuned to Hamburg's frequency, but put into an automatic standby mode. When the Hamburg transmitter went off the air because of the Allied bombers, the tone generated by the Milton Bryant radio stopped. There was a 5-millisecond click, and Aspidistra came on the air instead of Hamburg, with the German program being picked up by the British from Cologne. Now that people in northern Germany thought they were still listening to the Hamburg transmitter, the propagandists could make a few special announcements.
So, with that information and that transmitter, Dürmer's boys would go and carry on with announcements exactly in the same way, because they trained for this, and they were all German-speaking, of course. They would then give instructions to the public, saying that everybody should move to so-and-so, and the people should not do this, should not do that, and so on, quite a lot of instructions. And then after perhaps 5 minutes, no more, we would go off the air completely, and then the bombers would come. And, of course, people in Hamburg at that time would be convinced that they were given proper and more authoritative instructions. So we played this trick many times over. I suppose about 10 times altogether. And it was considered to be most effective.
Meanwhile, with the liberation of Calais, Soldatensender changed its name to Soldier Transmitter West. The music and doctored news continued.
Kameraden des Heeres im Westen und in Norwegen. Der Soldatensender West, angeschlossen der deutsche Kurzwellensender Atlantik, bringt jetzt seinen Kameradschaftsdienst für die Angehörigen des Heeres im Westen und in Norwegen.
Mind you, German Nazi propaganda wasn't standing still. Even though the up-tempo jazz music, played by Soldatensender, was banned by the official German radio, collaborators in northern France were paid to record the music being broadcast by Allied stations and send the discs to Germany. There, the music was transcribed, and some of it given to a peculiar jazz orchestra that had been formed to play for German radio's English service. A compere and singer called Karl Schwedler, who was clearly high up in the Nazi party, together with a well-paid group of jazz musicians, broadcast their versions of popular British and American hits twice a week.
Here's the latest song of the British Air bombing.
Let go bombing. Oh, let go bombing. Just like good old British airmen do. Let us bomb the French who were once our allies. England's fight for liberty, we make them realize. Let go shelling, where they're dwelling. Shelling Nanette, Dibri, and Lulu. Let us go to it. Let's do it. Let's drink their bullshit. Let's go bombing. It's becoming quite the thing to do.
The programs on Tuesday and Friday were introduced as Charlie and his orchestra. A few who did listen to it were treated to very sarcastic comments, which probably did more to put the Allies on the defensive than entertain them. Charlie had regular digs at the BBC, too.
When you're tuned in London Way, every evening and every day, you'll find some guys talking the way you walk. Every little commentary with its little sort of glee. You'll hear them all talking the way you walk. Everything CBC. Hear what you damn well please. Hear how the speakers lie there. Cry there. Die there. When you tune in London Way. Every evening, every day.
For Allied troops in North Africa, Berlin created a general overseas program designed to be confused with the forces network of the BBC. The relatively high-power commercial stations that had operated in Normandy and Luxembourg before the war were used by both sides. In early 1940, the former Radio Normandy, which had broadcast to England from France, was reopened for a while, ostensibly to broadcast to British troops in France, and also to broadcast some brief resistance messages to Austria and Czechoslovakia.
Now, the International Broadcasting Company's transmission is drawing to a close. And to those of you who are keeping watch on board the ships of the Seven Seas, bear witness and a good message.
But with the fall of France to the Germans, Radio International, as it was called, was hastily switched off. Further to the northeast, the Nazis used Radio Luxembourg's high-power medium-wave transmitter to strengthen reception of Lord Haw-Haw in Britain. But as the Allies pushed towards Berlin, so it became obvious that Germany was losing. On William Joyce's last broadcast, he'd clearly drunk far too much.
And therefore I say to you, in these last words, you may not hear from me again for a few months. I say, es liebe Deutschland, Heil Hitler, and farewell.
The Allies had liberated Luxembourg and had turned round the powerful propaganda tool towards Germany.
The transmitter was liberated in early 1945, and when it was liberated, it had been partially damaged by the retreating Germans. And it looked for a while as if the station would be off the air for quite a while because the final tubes had to be replaced. They were German tubes, and at the beginning, it was thought that there were no replacements. A young technician who now is very, very high in the organization that runs Radio Luxembourg, he was a very young technician in 1945, I knew where Spiros had been hidden away in the forest, found the Spiros, transmitter was put back on the air in just a few days. It then was used as a station broadcasting back to the Germans. In a somewhat different way, though, than the Germans used it for broadcasting to the Allies or to Britain. It was a station that warned towns within its signal range an advancing Allied army and offered the towns the possibility of surrender rather than destruction. I understand the first town that surrendered to Radio Luxembourg, which, by the way, was called by the Allies Little Orphan Annie. I don't know the origin of the name other than Little Orphan Annie was a very popular cartoon in the United States at the time. Later became a great Broadway play called Annie, by the way. But Little Orphan Annie alerted the German towns that the Allies were coming. The first town that surrendered, as I understand, to Little Orphan Annie, the first significant town, was Aachen.
On the 30th of April 1945, Sefton Delmer decided it was time to finish the Soldatensender project. After all, most of the area within the reach of the transmitter was now in Allied hands.
Delmer just decided to fade out. He said, I'm going to stop the program tomorrow. Just turn it off. And that's all. He didn't announce it.
So, what's left today? Well, Radio Luxembourg is still on the air with a variety of programs in several languages, including English, each evening. The Aspidistra medium-wave transmitter at Crowborough in southern England was used after the war to put out a press service to Hamburg until 1949. And later, the BBC finally got access to the site for broadcasts to Europe. A few years ago, all the equipment was written off and the bunker in Crowborough cleared out. The first set of studios at Waverden Towers is now owned by the local authority. Only at the larger studio site in Milton Bryant in Buckinghamshire are there any signs of the past. In fact, I'm now standing in front of the deserted 1930s utility building, once the home of Gustav Siegfried Einz and Soldatensender. Clearly a few people have broken in, probably tramps, and have taken anything of value. But as you walk around inside, you can still see where the studios once were, with windows separating the announcer and the engineer. Holes in the linoleum where the teleprinter stood for the news services. Even what looked like instructional notes in German scribbled on the wall. But was all this Allied wartime clandestine work worth the effort? Peter Weichmann was one of the German voices working here in Milton Bryant. We did get comebacks, as we called them, which suggested to us that our stations were widely listened to. And the seriousness with which the Nazi authorities took them was revealed in the secret orders which we captured. So they must have done some damage. But what is virtually impossible to gauge is to what extent they shortened the war. I mean, whether by a matter of hours, days, or optimistically weeks, is quite impossible to establish now. When it was all over, the British found one of Lord Haw Haw's studios in Hamburg and even tried it out.
This is Germany calling for the last time from Stilton, Hamburg. And in his place, this is the BBC calling all the long-suffering listeners in Britain who for 6 years have had to put up with the acid tones of Mr. Joyce speaking over the same wavelength that I'm using to talk to you now. I'm seated in front of Lord Haw Haw's own microphone, or rather, the microphone he used in the last 3 weeks of his somewhat checkered career.
And elsewhere in Germany, the American forces found a few secrets were waiting for them too. Roy Neal, European programming manager, back in 1945.
Inevitably, there was always the telltale, usually an 18 or 19-year-old boy who didn't give a damn about the Reich anymore and did give a darn about his hide. And through them, we found most of the broadcast circuits. We also found marvelous things like Rolls-Royce automobiles that had been buried to keep them from the Allies. And in terms of German equipment, we not only found their transmitters, we found the most magnificent thing of them all, magnetic tape recording. We uncovered the two doctors with their magnetophones. These were the original tape recorders. And they came along with the magnetophones and made them work. And through Armed Forces Radio Service, immediately following World War II, we suddenly made the world conscious of the fact that magnetic tape recording is a great way to go, and still is. Witness what you're hearing right now. In that concluding episode of Wartime Deception, you heard the voices of Roy Neal, Harold Robin, Peter Weichman, and George Jacobs. We would like to thank Phil Fothergill for his assistance with background research, and the Imperial War Museum in London for permission to use certain recordings in the documentary. The program was produced and presented by Jonathan Marks for Radio Netherlands, the Dutch international wireless station in Hilversum.
In December, we ran a two-part series on wartime clandestine broadcasts in Europe made by both sides. Kurt Ringel from Wiesbaden and the Federal Republic of Germany clearly enjoyed the detail we presented, but from his own research into the field, offered two updates concerning the mobile transmitters used by the Nazis for their external broadcasting.
It is not true that the truck-mounted transmitters had a standard broadcast power of 100 kilowatts. Each transmitter had a power of only 20 kilowatts. Up to three transmitters could be combined, though, resulting in a transmitting power of 60 kilowatts. You also said that the new British broadcasting station, NBBS, later became Workers' Challenge. In fact, both stations were different operations, the first one being codenamed Concordia N, the second one, Concordia S. Concordia N was a shortwave operation which lasted until April 1945. Concordia S was broadcast on 213 meters medium wave by the mobile transmitter A located at the Schelde estuary. The Loch Lomond song was only used by the NBBS at Sinon.
Well, thank you, Kurt, for that feedback. Thank you.